From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, politics can be taxing in more ways than one, some are finding out. Leading Democrats are accusing the GOP of taxing churches in their 2017 tax reform bill, and they, the Democrats, pledge to fix it and keep the IRS out of the offering plates. But are there bigger issues for churches when it comes to the IRS? We'll talk about it with Congressman Mike Johnson of Louisiana in just a moment. And the Senate is at a stalemate over the records of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says they want every document Kavanaugh touched while working in the George W. Bush White House. Is such a request reasonable, or is this just a stall tactic? We'll talk about it. It's Constitution Tuesday. Class will be in session a little bit later in the program as we are joined by Ken Klukowski, best-selling author and attorney, to talk about the confirmation process, the Constitution, and what's ahead as it pertains to the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And we'll be taking your phone calls and questions. So class is in session. We'll be taking your questions. You got questions about the Constitution, questions about the confirmation process, questions about the nominee. Well, Ken Klukowski joins me, and we take your questions later here on Washington Watch. All right, I mentioned this yesterday, a new tool for your activist toolkit. If you want to be engaged in, let me tell you, our republic was not made for spectators, but for participants. We have just what you need. The Stand Firm app. That's right. We have a new tool. It's called the Stand Firm app, and we're building a network of a nationwide network of activists. You know, people talking about how Facebook and other social media platforms are elbowing conservatives out. Well, look, we're going straight to conservatives across the country and networking them together. Go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over, and download the Stand Firm app. By the way, for those of you listening, obviously, you can listen to the program, but we're not in every city. We're in a lot of cities, but not every city. So if you've got friends across the country, they can listen to Washington Watch via the Stand Firm app. So either go to the App Store, Stand Firm app, or go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links over. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me at T. Perkins, although I recommend the app. Stand Firm. All right. Okay. Democratic members of Congress are making hay over a provision in the 2017 tax reform bill that was, it was not really discovered by the media until after the bill was enacted into law. Now, under the provision, churches and other nonprofits, including groups like the Family Research Council, will be required to pay a 21% tax on the value of parking and public transit cost for employees. Now, they're making this into a much bigger issue. I have a problem with it for the principle of it. It is not a huge amount of money we're talking about. What we're talking about are nonprofits and churches that, for instance, this applies mostly to those in cities, big cities where it's costly to park. And so you give a benefit to an employee, you pay for a monthly parking space, and that's been a non-taxable benefit. Well, under this, there's a 21% tax on that. Same that you give them here in the city. We've got the Metro. People ride the Metro in order to cut down on cars. You know, that's a benefit that's been provided. Well, now there's a 21% tax on it. So it's not across-the-board levy of tax of church, but the principle remains the same. Joining us now is Congressman Mike Johnson. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Louisiana, serves on the House Judiciary Committee, and is actually a co-sponsor of legislation along with Congressman Mark Walker, the current president or current chairman, I should say, of the Republican Study Committee, that would actually correct this in the tax reform bill of 2017. Mike, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you.
Are your Democratic colleagues overstating the issue here of the GOP bringing down the IRS upon the churches through this 21% tax on parking benefits?
I think they are overstating it, and that's not a big surprise. I think they're trying to turn it into some sort of political wedge issue, but this is truly is a bipartisan concern, and obviously conservative Republicans in the House were the first to raise the alarm, and we've already filed the legislation to correct it. I'm very optimistic that that will be done. We'll get it over the finish line here very shortly, and it will resolve the issue. So it's unfortunate, you know, that they're banging the drums about this when, you know, some of our liberal friends, some of the Democrats on the other side of the aisle have never really seemed all that concerned about what's happening with the tax-exempt status of our churches if you look at some of the other issues that affected them, and that's why all this is pretty interesting to us.
Now, I think in principle you would certainly agree whether it's a $5 we're talking about or $5,000, the principle is the same, that this appears to be the government reaching into the church for tax purposes. So I as you have pointed out, conservatives caught this and are working to fix it. But the issue of the IRS in the churches, there's a much bigger issue, and one that we've talked about here on this program many times, and one that you've actually worked to address in Congress along with the majority whip, Steve Scalise and Jody Heiss of Georgia, and that is the issue of the Johnson Amendment, where the IRS is limiting the speech potentially of churches.
They have been doing that. And look, here's the idea behind this, and you and I have discussed it many times, that repealing the Johnson Amendment has been a campaign commitment of President Trump and so many of us who ran for Congress. Prior to being elected to Congress in December 2016, I was a constitutional law attorney, as you know, used to litigate these cases. I worked for the Alliance Defending Freedom for much of my career, and we were defending the free speech and free exercise of religion all over the country, and those freedoms of churches as well. The Johnson Amendment has been a thorn in everyone's side, and the reason is, since 1954, since, you know, the amendment is named for Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, he inserted this amendment into a larger IRS bill that prohibited for the first time, he changed the Internal Revenue Code, for the first time in 1954, all nonprofits and churches were prohibited from engaging in any activity that might be interpreted by someone as, quote-unquote, participating in a campaign on or behalf of a candidate for public office. What it effectively has done since that time, Tony, as you well know, is that it's worked as sort of a censorship tool for the voice of the church. You know, you have the IRS now positioned as a judge and jury over the activities of ministers and charities, all nonprofits, and it's created a real chilling effect on the free exercise of religion and the exercise of free speech, and that's a problem that we need to correct. And I hope our Democrats, Democrat friends, will be consistent, intellectually consistent here with their concern, and help us get this thing finally fixed.
So have you heard from them? Are they willing now, as they've now expressed the concern over the IRS and churches, are they willing to create that, re-erect, I should say, that constitutional firewall between the church and the IRS?
Well, one would hope. You know, we've all left for the August district work period, so there hasn't been a lot of convocation on this issue yet. But I'll tell you, I'm very interested to get back the first week of September and pull some of my Democrat colleagues aside, some of those who have been the most vocal about this newly added section in the code regarding the, you know, the de minimis fringe benefit of the parking and all that, to say, hey, I'm so glad that you're concerned about that. So are we. Now let's talk about the broader issue. You're worried about churches and nonprofits having to pay a few dollars for the fringe benefit of parking. Let's look at the big issue, I mean the monster issue, that their entire tax-exempt status could be taken away, at least on paper, according to the Johnson Amendment, if they speak in the wrong manner, if they do something, you know, to address the moral and social concerns of the day, to talk about an upcoming political campaign, their entire tax-exempt status can be put in jeopardy. And surely, I would say to my Democrat friends, and intend to do so, surely you would not be in favor of that. So we'll see what they say, Tony.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Mike Johnson, Congressman of Louisiana's 4th Congressional District, representing Louisiana's 4th Congressional District, my guest. Mike, in a McClatchy, Washington Bureau story on this topic from yesterday. One of your colleagues, Emmanuel Cleaver, who represents a district in Missouri, who is also a United Methodist pastor, making reference to the discovery of this tax issue, said, had we had hearings, and I'm quoting him, I can assure you I would have been testifying or screaming about this matter. So clearly, you know, I would think maybe they don't understand the threat that the IRS poses in terms of the Johnson Amendment, or why do we not see more Democratic members of Congress concerned about how the IRS is being used to silence pulpits?
It's a very good question, and I'm really not being flippant here at all, Tony, when I say that I intend to go to Congressman Cleaver and others and talk with them about this in a very rational way. This what we're talking about in repealing the Johnson Amendment should indeed be a bipartisan effort. I mean, this legislation is simply going to restore the free speech rights that have been unconstitutionally censored and silenced for more than 60 years by an amendment that is unconstitutional on its face. We would have had the Johnson Amendment struck down in the courts many years ago, but the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, will never allow that legal challenge. We tried to spark that legal challenge, as you know, with Public Freedom Sunday activities for almost a decade now. We've mailed in sermons where pastors have violated that legislation on its face. And the IRS has never allowed us to have that challenge because they're afraid if we got in a federal court, clearly the First Amendment would trump this unconstitutional piece of legislation. So in the meantime, the Congress needs to do its job. The law should be made by the legislative body, and we ought to have a broad bipartisan consensus on this because exactly what he said. We have to protect this most cherished tradition, this American tradition of that goes back more than a century, to ensure that churches and other nonprofits are allowed to speak freely. It's an important part of who we are as Americans.
Well, I certainly would join them in rescinding this tax provision on churches and nonprofits, and I hope they will join with you in rescinding the Johnson Amendment, which is a much greater threat because of the muzzle that it potentially places. On churches. Now, I do want to, we just got a couple minutes left, Congressman Johnson, I do want to point out that I think this is part of the problem of the legislative process currently, the massive size of pieces of legislation. We saw this back in the Obamacare where it was rushed through and only to discover all these problems afterwards. There are so many unintended consequences that we find from this. How do we fix that so we're more thorough in going through this legislation on the front side?
Well, process is a big part of it, and we've talked about that at great length, and in not having omnibus spending bills, for example, and not having legislation that's so large and complex that these unintended consequences can't be foreseen. But, you know, I'll say this in defense of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It is a massive undertaking, obviously, to revise the Internal Revenue Code. Yeah. It's a job that was decades overdue. And I think the Ways and Means Committee and Chairman Brady and everyone who had a hand in the legislation did a masterful job. There's a few minor unintended consequences. We are going to fix them. But, you know, it's to be expected when you have legislation that large. As a general sense, right?
And it's working. And it's working. Mike, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. It is working.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In 3 states and 2 large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage, and this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, Visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values Voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Hello? Can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. In the wake of a consistent pattern of censorship by tech companies of lawful but politically incorrect viewpoints, particularly those of conservatives and Christians, what is the legal status of digital free expression? Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? The panel speakers were Congressman Marsha Blackburn, Civil Liberties Attorney Craig Parshall, and Brent Scorum, Senior Research Fellow in the Technology Policy Program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice. Again, that's frc.org/voice.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
All right, it's Constitution Tuesday. Class is in session. All right, throughout the confirmation process of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, we're going to take a closer look at the Constitution, the process. Going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take this as an opportunity to really educate people on the importance of this process, the three co-equal branches of government. The judicial branch is not the strongest. In fact, we'll talk about, I'm sure, along this process, how many of the founders saw it as the weakest. But yet it seems to hold all the others by the throat. So anyway, we're going to be talking about those issues throughout, as I said, on Tuesdays, throughout the confirmation process. And joining me today as we hold class on the Constitution is our good friend Ken Klukowski, best-selling author, senior counsel and director of strategic affairs for First Liberty Institute, and a fellow and senior legal analyst with the American Civil Rights Union. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thanks for having me.
All right, Ken, I want to start off. We're going to be taking calls in the next segment. So, folks, jot down your questions, take notes, and we're going to open up the phone lines in the next segment. And you're going to be able to ask Ken and myself questions regarding the Constitution, about the process. But I want to start with this. Today, news coming out that the Senate is in a stalemate, the Democrats wanting more records than many would think are reasonable. Certainly, Chuck Grassley, who was on the program last week, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says, look, we're giving them all the documents that are out there. But they want to go back. I say they, the Democrats in the Senate, want every document that passed through the desk, on the desk of Brett Kavanaugh when he was in the White House as the president's secretary, kind of staff secretary. Is that a reasonable request to have every document that he facilitated back during his time in the White House?
Absolutely unreasonable, Tony, and we can put numbers to that to back it up. To this point, all right, now we have with Judge Kavanaugh, if you want to know how to evaluate his record, go ahead and read the 6,160 pages of his 300 judicial opinions since he became a federal appeals judge 12 years ago, because that'll tell you exactly what he thinks of the law. He just spends all of his time unpacking the law, talking about the law, expressing his philosophy of the law and how he interprets the Constitution and federal statutes and federal regulations and everything else. But instead of that, they're asking for these documents that you just mentioned. Now, before him, I think the all-time high for a document release was for Justice Elena Kagan. Now, the reason that hers was the highest is she had never been a judge before, the only non-judge in decades to go to the high court. And so there were people saying, well, since we don't have court opinions that she wrote that we could look at, we're trying to figure out what else we can find. And they got 172,000 pages of documents on Elena Kagan, 172,000, okay? What Chuck Grassley, as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the White House and the National Archives, between them, what they agreed to give the Senate Democrats for Kavanaugh was 1 million pages of documentation. They're getting 1 million pages, more than five times, close to seven times, what was for Elena Kagan. And again, I believe that hers was the record. So we're talking about already, they're going seven times over the pre-existing record. Check this out. For the White House staff secretary, now for all of our listeners, that's the clearinghouse for all the papers that go through the White House to and from the president. Now, it includes, of course, like bills coming from Congress, but you don't need to subpoena anything for that because those things are on the law books. It also includes the staff secretary's office handles the menu for Air Force One on every flight, okay? Now, I would like to think, Tony, that whether they serve chicken or beef on November 9 of the year 2005 has nothing to do with how Brett Kavanaugh interprets the Constitution of the United States. This is all about numbers. It's all about obstruction. Because, as I said, they're already getting 1 million pages, which is several times over an all-time record. If they were to get everything from the White House staff that went through the White House staff secretary's office, it would be closer to 8 million pages. So this is pure obstruction. They're trying to get 8 million pages of material so that they can say, and oh, by the way, it's going to take us about 5 years to read through all this, so we can't have a confirmation vote until the next presidential election.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite evident. I want to ask you this question when you compare the writings, and we're almost up against a break here, but the...
Yeah, compare that was a long answer on my part.
No, that's fine. The role of a staff secretary to the role of a Supreme Court justice. I mean, the things that he would write or note on a document coming across his desk. How does that give you insight into his judicial philosophy?
Oh, none.
I'm going to have you answer that on the other side of the break. Okay.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tony.
All right, folks, when we come back, Ken's going to answer my question, and then we're going to take your questions because class is in session. No recess, okay? All right, we're going to come back. We're going to be talking about the Constitution, the role of the courts, the confirmation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. All those things on the table. Give us a call, 866-372-7234. Class is in session right here on Washington Watch. Don't go away. We're coming right back with more Washington Watch after this. Now, you can do this during the break. Download the Stand Firm app. All right? That's your homework. All right, don't go away. Coming back.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In three states and two large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage, and this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values Voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Class is in session. It's Constitution Tuesday. We're talking with Ken Klukowski, best-selling author, senior counsel, and director of strategic affairs for First Liberty Institute, fellow and senior legal analyst with the American Civil Rights Union. As we make our way toward the Senate vote on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to replace the vacancy created by the retiring, in fact, today is his last day, Justice Kennedy retiring from the court. And so we're going to take this opportunity over the next several weeks to take some time on Tuesdays just to talk about the role of the courts and what's happening both in current affairs, but also just in a greater understanding of the role, limited role, I should say, that the court should play. So we're going to be taking your phone calls here in just a moment, 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Go ahead and get to the head of the class. You can ask your question. All right, Ken, I asked you a question on the way out there. How do you compare the role of the staff secretary and the notations that he might write on someone else's document? How does that compare in terms of or how do you use that to determine one's judicial philosophy as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, in fact, Tony, as an article that I'm writing for Breitbart News that'll be out for tomorrow morning sets forth, Chairman Chuck Grassley made the point on the Senate floor just a few days ago that these staff secretary documents are the least relevant possible documents that you could have because you don't even have to be a lawyer to be staff secretary. It's not even a legal job at all. Like I said, now it's an important job because you're managing, you're in a sense like a traffic cop for all of the paper going in and out of the office of the president, which in a country of, 320 million people and a $4 trillion federal government, I mean, there's an awful lot of paper that goes around that place. But the staff secretary doesn't draft policy memoranda. He doesn't express legal views. You know, it's if there are modifications to documents, they're editing marks. They're not substantive changes. Right. And as I said, it's not even.
But might they try to attribute the content of a document, if he just made a notation on it, tried to attribute that thought or whatever the subject might be, attribute it to him? Is that part of what might be going on?
I think that's exactly what some hyper-partisan Senate Democrats would do. Perhaps someone like Cory Booker, who, as I quote in a story going up tonight, Cory Booker, who said a few days ago that to vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh was to become, quote, complicit with evil. Okay, or Terry McAuliffe positioning for a 2020 presidential run, who said that lives will literally be endangered. American lives could be lost if Brett Kavanaugh is put on the court. Or Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon, who said that this is paving, quote, the path to tyranny. I mean, these people are becoming unglued. I mean, this
a little bit of an overreach over the top.
That's right. And when you're in that kind of environment, yes, I expect that if he inserts a semicolon in a sentence written by someone else, we could expect an attack ad saying, quoting that sentence, and then saying, this document came from the desk of Brett Kavanaugh.
All right, we're going to go to the phone lines here, Ken, because we've got students lined up here to ask questions. 866-372-7234 if you've got a question. By the way, I just wanted to make this notation. You mentioned Kagan. I actually testified before the Senate committee when she was nominated. What we pointed to as the head of the law school. She, as you said, she had not been a judge, but she had served as the dean of the law school.
At Harvard,
and the things that she wrote had bearing and relevance upon her judicial philosophy in that role. She was the dean of law school, those type of documents, but she wasn't processing other people's work. She was doing her own. Just in case someone wanted to pointed that. That was
the writings of other Harvard law professors during her tenure, she is not responsible for those words.
Right. Only her own words. Okay. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Becky in Texas. Becky, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. And Becky, appreciate the work you do to keep us educated. Can you hear me?
Well, thank you. Yes, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I studied the Constitution when I was in high school, and I realized that was many years ago. But when did the courts start?
Well, it hadn't changed.
Well, that's what I don't understand. All of a sudden, we get a Supreme Court decision, and it becomes the law of the land. They don't make laws. They decide on one case. Congress makes laws.
All right.
When did this stop?
Okay. Becky, that music means we're up against a break. When we come back on the other side of the break, Ken is going to answer your question. When did the courts start making laws? When did they become so political? Becky's right. I remember that. The Constitution hasn't changed. When did the court become so powerful in shaping laws, and were there some of our founders that warned that that might happen? Ken Kulkowski is going to answer that question on the other side of the break, and we'll be taking more phone calls here on this Constitution Tuesday as class is in session. Don't go away. Coming right back after this.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In 3 states and 2 large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage. And this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, Visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values Voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Hello? Can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. In the wake of a consistent pattern of censorship by tech companies of lawful but politically incorrect viewpoints, particularly those of conservatives and Christians, what is the legal status of digital free expression? Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? The panel speakers were Congressman Marsha Blackburn, civil liberties attorney Craig Parshall, and Brent Scorum, senior research fellow in the technology policy program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice. Again, that's frc.org/voice.
I'm Tony Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch, and the class is in session on this Constitution Tuesday as we are taking time out over the next several weeks as the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh goes forward. Just taking this time, this opportunity to take a closer look at the process, the Constitution, three branches of government, in particular, the role of the judiciary. Okay, we had a question, Ken, going into that break, and that was, when did the court start making law? When did they become so political? And were there founders that warned that the court might overstep its boundaries?
Well, in fact, that becomes two separate questions, Tony. I mean, we inherited a legal system from England. It's called the common law system, and that is different from what you had in the rest of Europe, or which is called the civil law system, which is actually what you have in your home state of Louisiana. The other 49 states have a common law system. And under common law systems, and Louisiana has also adopted parts of this, whenever a court renders a decision, it is, first of all, of course, entirely binding regarding the rights and the obligations of the parties before the court in that case, but also the rule created by the court to decide the case becomes a binding precedent that becomes part of the law that governs within within the jurisdiction of that court. Now, the issue is this, and this is where we have to be careful with the word law. At the federal level, Congress makes the law. In the states, legislatures make the law, but by that we mean statute. Here we're talking about a broader definition of law, meaning all positive law, meaning all written law, which isn't just the statutes that are made by elected lawmakers, but if Congress passes a law, passes a statute, and it authorizes the Secretary of Transportation to make some regulations regarding building highways or highway safety, and then the Secretary of Transportation does that, those regulations also carry the force of law. But if you get a trucking company driving on that and they get a citation because supposedly the load they're carrying violates that regulation, and they go to court to sue over that, the court's decision is interpreting both Congress's law and the Transportation Department's regulations. And that interpretation to decide that case is also what's called decisional law, or it creates binding precedent. So that's how you have the separation of powers, that in a nation under the rule of law, you have three branches, one that makes the law, a second that administers and enforces the law, and a third branch that interprets the law. But those are all different parts of what you mean by the law in a broad sense of the word. And that started in 1789.
Let me continue that illustration there, because what you have in that particular illustration, you have the court simply trying to determine exactly what the legislative body meant and how the executive actually executed it,
right,
and that the two are in concert.
Yes.
But what we've seen, for instance, in the most infamous of activist court cases being Roe v. Wade, we've seen the courts go beyond anything that's been stated by the legislative branch and create law. They've created it. And I think that's
I'm so glad you raised that, Tony. And let's take Roe as an example. In fact, I was going to use Dred Scott as an example, but let's get right to Roe v. Wade. Perfect example. Another kind of positive law that we have in this country, in fact, the highest level of positive law, is the Constitution of the United States, which was not adopted by lawmakers. It was adopted directly by the American people. And lawmakers, Congress, and state, both at the federal and state level, everyone takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That as the supreme law of the land, it is actually supersedes everything you do through the normal legislative process. What we're talking about here is something we've dealt with since the year 1803, Marbury versus Madison, and that is the power of judicial review. And that is that whenever something created by a lawmaker or by an executive branch official, whether it's a statute or a regulation or whatever it is, if it conflicts with the Constitution of the United States, then the Constitution trumps. It prevails as the supreme law of the land. What happened in Roe v. Wade, and it wasn't the first time the court had done it, but as you said, it is an infamous example, one of the top five, surely, in all of American history, is that there the U.S. Supreme Court invented out of whole cloth that there is some sort of constitutional right in the Constitution, that you can't find it in the words of the Constitution, you can't find it in the Constitution's structure or history, but they just said it's implicit. You know, it's written in invisible ink in the Constitution.
Well, you find it in the shadows.
They go on and they talk about emanations and penumbras and this whole idea of inventing rights that the American people never voted on to put in the Constitution, and even at a lower level that no lawmaker ever voted to do. But they said that it's in the Constitution and that as such, no one even gets to vote on it. As such, everyone is bound to follow this. And this is what we refer to when we speak of judicial activism. It's the philosophy of what is called a living Constitution, that even though, as you said, and it was so important what you said to your listener a moment ago, when you said the words haven't changed to the Constitution. If we want to change it, we have to pass an amendment process. And we've done that a couple dozen times, but it's something the American people get involved with. And whether it's the original document or any amendment, we all know what it says because they're words written on paper, and we debated those words and we voted on those words.
So let's talk. We're going to go to another. Jim, hold on there in Mississippi. We're coming to you here in just a minute, Jim. But that is one of the To put context to a term that we're hearing out there a lot about, strict constructionist, a textualist, that's exactly what we're talking about here. We're talking about a judge, a justice, who will simply read the words of the Constitution and apply them to that legislative activity or that executive branch initiative based upon how the Constitution was plainly written and intended. That's what we mean by that term.
That's right. And in fact, the lawyer's term for it is an originalist, and that is that the Constitution must only be interpreted according to the original public meaning of its words from consulting its text, its history, and its structure. And it understands that we are in a democratic society. In America, the default rule is people get to rule themselves. Everyone gets to vote. When you say something's in the Constitution, it means the voting has to stop. And because of that, judges who hold life tenure, who are unelected and politically unaccountable, that they only have a very narrow role that's legitimate in such a democratic system, and that's why they must only follow and always follow the original public meaning of the supreme law that they're applying in that case.
And that's why this is such a huge battle, because we're talking about reining in exactly what she was talking about, and that is judges who make law, because they'll be abiding by the Constitution, not the words of the Constitution, not finding things in the shadows.
That's
okay.
Right.
Let's go on to our – I got to get in a few more of our students here today, Ken, so let me get to them. You're listening to Washington Watch. Ken Klukowski, my guest, Constitution Tuesday, taking your questions, and we're going to Jim in Columbus, Mississippi. Jim, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's really hard to hear you on your back and forth listening on the air. I don't know what the problem is, but it's very distorted.
All right, we'll check it out.
My mind races to the statement that Jefferson made. He said, "Let us bind the government down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution." Well, he's speaking metaphorically because there are no literal chains. But if there were any, what would the chain be made of? It would have to be made of individuals who are linked together in a like-minded understanding of the Constitution to know when government is getting out of bounds, exercising outside of their jurisdiction, or getting off the foundation of principle. And I'd like to segue that into the preamble of the Constitution, because we are getting so far off of our foundations that the preamble is really the only benchmark that we have to really show us how far off we're getting. When we're importing a hostile ideology like Islam, how do we form a more perfect union by doing that? How are we securing the blessings of liberty? So there's your standard and your rule measuring stick to show you, you know, where we are in relation to what the original goal and intent was. How do we achieve ensuring domestic tranquility and establishing justice when we interpret that public desecration of the American flag is a legitimate First Amendment right? Well, go back to your benchmark and use it as a guide. And
all right.
We're not doing that.
Let me go to Ken. And Ken, Jim makes some really good points.
Well, it's Tony, what we have is actually the preamble of the Constitution is the only part that does not have independent legal force. And as I think the caller was suggesting, it forms the context. It forms the frame for the picture that then is set forth in each of the operative provisions of the Constitution. The reality, though, is for most of those, it's democracy. The preamble includes aspirations, you know, things that we set a goal to, that we aspire to. But most of that is carried out, to the extent it's carried out at all, by government. Most of that is carried out by the citizens themselves through voting. And then when they vote for lawmakers and for executive branch officials, both federal and state here, most of it's at the state level as far as the Constitution is concerned, the idea was that people would do that through the governmental decisions that they were making through politically accountable lawmakers and executives on a day-to-day basis. If you look to the preamble of the Constitution, there is actually no judicial role, no role for the courts in those opening words of the Constitution. It is instead left to the people and to the rulers who are accountable to the people because they were chosen by the people for a short period of time.
All right, Ken Klukowski, going to work in another call here before we run out of time. Let's go to, well, my home state of Louisiana, where Daniel is on the line. Daniel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hello?
Yeah, turn your radio down and ask your question, Daniel.
Oh, yes. My call pretty much goes back on the other person's call when you talked about the flag burning. I mean, I serve this country to protect freedom of speech, but I have a hard time with that decision. I kind of disagree. I mean, I disagree that people should be able to disrespect a flag like that. That just seems like pretty treasonous to me. I mean, you can feel free to comment. Thank you, sir.
All right. I'll get Ken Daniel to weigh in on that. And by the way, thank you for your service to our country. Ken, what about that? Obviously some competing issues there.
Well, and yes, Daniel, thank you for your service. The reality is, and this ties into what we're talking about, all right, the Supreme Court said in 1989 in Texas v. Johnson that burning the American flag is actually protected by the First Amendment. And the interesting thing is that you had a split court. Justice Scalia, who was the most conservative member of the court at the time, was actually in the majority on that one, along with Justices Brennan and Thurgood Marshall, who were the most liberal ones in the court at the time. The dissenting justices, it was a 6-3 decision, a 5-4 decision. Three of the dissenters, there was one conservative, two moderates, and one liberal in dissent. But that actually did not turn upon clear philosophical lines. Justice Scalia made it clear in subsequent speeches and whatnot that he strongly opposed burning the American flag. He just thought it was constitutionally protected. But the solution to that then, if that is protected by the First Amendment, and again, that's what the Supreme Court says, doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It means it's the law of the land, is that they said, if you think it should be forbidden, and the majority of the Supreme Court says it's protected by the First Amendment, the power still rests with the people because you can pass a constitutional amendment to prohibit it. And there was, for years, people tried, of course, to pass a flag-burning amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It never got all the way through the process. But again, that is something that ultimately the people have the final say in our form of government.
That is the process. And the process here is when we run out of time, we have to stop. Ken Klukowski, thanks so much for joining us today. All right, I had our first Constitution Tuesday. And we'll be revisiting this, and Ken will sure to be back. He is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the Constitution and the judiciary. All right, folks, guess what? Class is out of session. But your homework is download the app, the Stand Firm app. Go to TonyPerkins.com and get it. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.